As true crime enthusiasts, we often hear those stories of people who seemingly vanished into thin air, but by far, one of the most perplexing stories that has haunted me recently is the disappearance of 16-year-old Allie Lewitzer. She disappeared on April 26, 2010 in Spring, Texas, just after stepping off of her school bus. She told her mother, Joanne, she was walking to her job at the local burger barn. She was excited to pick up her paycheck. This would later be confirmed by multiple eyewitnesses. Allie stepped off of the bus, sent a text message to her friend, then her phone completely shut off. No trace of Allie has ever been found. And over 16 years later, her loved ones are still searching for answers. I had the amazing opportunity to connect with Allie's mother, Joanne, at CrimeCon this year, and I immediately felt connected to her. If Allie were still here, she and I would have graduated at the same time. We would be the same age. Joanne is very sweet. She's gentle, but she's a hard worker, and she's still fighting every day for her missing daughter. Through this talk with Joanne, which you're going to hear in just a few minutes, I also learned she and her family were the ones doing all of the work in her daughter's disappearance. They were doing the cell phone pings, putting up the missing persons flyers, getting the surveillance footage, logging into Allie's email, and organizing searches. Police didn't do much of anything for Allie. They didn't even issue an Amber Alert. They labeled Allie a runaway. Today, Joanne works with her hands to feel closer to her artistic daughter. She connects with other moms of missing children. She advocates for Allie on social media and at advocacy events. She joined Texas EquiSearch and got formal training, searching for other missing persons. And Joanne feels she's found her voice throughout this entire process. Joanne even said sometimes she wonders if her daughter went missing so that she could help find someone else that's missing. It was an absolute honor to hear Allie's story through the words of her mother's heart, and I simply adore her. I know you will too. Today's perplexing episode is all about the case of missing 16-year-old Allie Lewitzer. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Perplexity, a Mystery Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Kadra. If you're new, hello and welcome. I tell tales every single week that have perplexed me. So if you love a good mystery that leaves you wanting more, you are in the right place. If you end up enjoying today's special interview episode with Joanne Lewitzer, I would love if you continue to follow along. If you are a returning listener, hello, my friends, welcome back. I'm happy you're here today. I have Allie Lewitzer's mom with me, Joanne. Joanne, do you want to introduce yourself?
Joanne Lewitzer.
So happy you're here, Joanne.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to come and talk. I just feel like when we spoke briefly at CrimeCon, I feel like I had seen you and talked to you before. I don't know if you ever meet anybody like that, but I walked away with feeling that I had already kind of gotten to know you.
I felt that way too. And before we started recording, I was telling Joanne, for everybody listening, her story has really stuck with me. I've been thinking about your daughter, Allie, a lot. And Allie and I were the same age when she disappeared. A lot of likes, you know, I was artistic. I grew up in theater and did choir. I loved singing. I also liked to do art and draw and stuff like that. And went through my eyeliner phase and just very, it's interesting doing more of these interview episodes because you get to hear the real raw stories. And yeah, I don't know. I felt like we had a really good conversation at CrimeCon. And I think you have a very important story that not enough people are talking about, and just anything that we can do to spread awareness and help. So yeah, I would love for you to tell my listeners about Allie.
First, I want to mention Coraline over your left shoulder. Me and Allie absolutely loved Coraline. and everything in that type of, I don't know if you call it a genre or whatever, but we were big fans of Tim Burton, and she liked some of the same music as me and her dad, and, you know, which is like a 90s alternative, but music was a big part of her and her personality. And if I say is or was, I kind of struggle with that. I guess it depends on what I'm saying about Allie. Yeah, so I had a quilt made of her t-shirts, and there are some of my t-shirts on it that she kind of took over, and then a couple from her dad, you know, like there's a Korn t-shirt and a couple of Metallica t-shirts, but hers, Green Day, and some Girl Scout t-shirts and softball t-shirts. And then I don't know if you had ever heard of BuzzFest, but, you know, there's a different concerts on top of the 90s alternative that she kind of took on from me and her dad. You know, one of her favorites was the Beatles, and she loved music so much. I don't know if you looked at my YouTube channel, but there's a video of her on there singing the national anthem. And I'm so glad that I had an old camcorder that I was recording that, you know, because now I can go back and I can watch that anytime I want to. And, you know, she was just on top of music. You know, she was very artistic. She loved to draw and write and paint and almost any form of outlet you can think of. She was into it, even drawing on her schoolwork, which got her in trouble with some of her teachers. But she was very shy to meet new people. I guess it depended on that person, you know, if they were the type of person that would just draw her in, she was more comfortable that way, if that makes any sense.
I can relate to that being I call it an introverted extrovert or an ambivert.
Yes.
So
yes.
If someone approaches me, then I'll start talking. But otherwise, I'm more reserved and shy.
Yeah. And I'm the same way. Like if you girls didn't stop and talk to me at my table, you know, I wouldn't have talked to y'all. So I don't know if she gets that from me naturally or was just, yeah, it was just her. And she was passionate about her animals. When she went missing, we had two dogs. And before she went missing, she's had a turtle and fish and hamsters, and we could never have any cats because I'm deathly allergic to cats.
Oh no.
Yeah. One of the first things that when Mason moved out and I went and visited him, you know, he broke the news to me. He says, "Mom, I'm going to get a cat." And I'm like, "Oh no." But, you know, I didn't blame him one bit. But yeah, so I know if Allie were around today, she would just have tons of animals.
She sounds like a very caring, intuitive, talented person. It's really cool to hear about her. And I also want to say, because you brought up Coraline at the beginning, Coraline is one of my favorite movies. It's so well done, and I watch it like every year. So when I set up my podcast studio and I got all these objects behind me, I was going through Etsy trying to find cool stuff. And that was like one of the first things that I got.
Yeah, I love it. And Allie was not a Barbie girl, which I was kind of disappointed in that, because I absolutely loved Barbies growing up. And yeah, I still love them today, but I do more collecting than actually playing with them. But yeah, they actually came out with the Coraline doll, and it sold out so quickly, I missed it.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I would have loved to have added her to my collection. She would be right next to my Wednesday Addams doll.
Oh, wait, I have the hand behind me, actually.
Oh, you have thing?
Yeah, wait, there you go. You see it?
Oh, yeah. That's awesome.
That's too funny. So, okay, I'm curious, what Allie was like in adolescence and like her relationships, the family dynamic.
Well, she's my youngest child. I have two. Her older brother, Mason, is about 2.5, 3 years older than her. And growing up, she would have rather played with his toys than the ones that we felt were appropriate for girls, dolls and dress up. Well, she did love to play dress up, but yeah, I mean, she didn't mind playing in the dirt and trying to play tag along with her brother and his friends. And then teenager, I guess junior high-ish, her weight fluctuated. So there was a time where, like in sixth grade, she was a little chunky and she got picked on for that. And then the seventh grade, like she trimmed down quite a bit. We were still playing softball and she had her first serious boyfriend in seventh grade. His name was Dylan. And it wasn't a very healthy relationship. He was a year older than her and had already had girlfriends. And for it being your first relationship, she cried a lot. And I know that he was kind of popular. And some of the other girls, which were also her friends, also was all in awe for him. So I think that caused some problems. And I honestly was relieved when they completely called it quits. And I know after that, I mean, she had a couple of boys that she was interested in, but nobody's as serious as your first boyfriend.
Right.
Yeah, but she, I guess because she was a little shy, she did get picked on because she wouldn't stick up for herself. And let's see, I don't know. I don't know what else.
That's okay. What was the family dynamic like? What did like a typical day after school look like around your house?
It was usually pretty busy. Allie was always busy. We had Girl Scouts and softball. And then in junior high school, she added band. So she played the flute in junior high school. She wanted to play, I think it was the clarinet, I think. Either the clarinet or the oboe. But the band teacher said that she had flute lips, and I guess because they were kind of thin, so she ended up playing the flute. So if, you know, when we would get home from school and work, I would usually have to rush and get her ready for something, and then, you know, usually softball, and we would run to softball. It would either be practice or a game, and which I enjoyed it because I didn't play outside school sports whenever I was in school. So I guess when you have kids and you kind of live some of your aspirations or whatever through them.
Sure.
So when she wanted to switch from band to choir, you know, I was like, yes, of course. Yeah. So that happened in the ninth grade. She switched to choir because she did not want to do the marching band.
It is very demanding to do marching band. It's hot in Texas. It's long hours. I understand.
Yeah. So I'm kind of glad that she switched as well.
Yeah.
Because that would have meant, you know, that I was going to be out there in it too. But yeah, I mean, I guess there were days when it was just go, go, go. And then, you know, some days where, you know, we had chill time at home, and she would spend a lot of her downtime drawing or having a friend over, stuff like that. We usually were into some type of art and creating something.
And when did you guys move to Spring, Texas, or how long had you been there?
We moved from Pasadena. We bought our first house in Spring, which was in 2000.
Okay. And what brought you there?
Better school district, better area. So I was born and raised in Pasadena, and it's the nickname, I don't know if you know this or not, but the nickname for Pasadena is Stinkadena.
I did not know that.
Yes, because it's a very industrial city, meaning like chemical plants. There was a paper mill, you know, all along the 225 corridor. it was just plants and smokestacks and like the Shell refinery and Chevron. And there was like some plastic plants and stuff like that. So it was very stinky. The air was stinky. And yeah, we just wanted to change of pace and a nicer area. So, sure. And the school district was a lot better. And plus, I was having to commute. So I worked up by the big airport. And so it would have been closer to my work and a little bit closer for John to work also.
And what was spring like during that time? Like, how was the community?
It was good. There was lots of trees. Now, it's not rural. So, you know, we don't have like acres of land and a house and stuff like that. I mean, we do live in a subdivision, but when you get out of the subdivision and we were going to go to the mall or go to the woodlands, and it would just be trees on both sides of the street. And it was really nice. It was nice enough where Allie called them her trees. Because when we moved up here, she was in first grade. And when you're at young elementary, you know, you have that type of imagination. She definitely used her imagination. And yeah, she would call them her trees. I think she would be very disappointed now because I've lived in this house for 26 years and most of those trees are gone and now there's houses.
That is sad. The Austin Metroplex too, and I'm sure it's like this in Houston as well. It's just, it's growing constantly. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think being out in nature is so important. So seeing that go away is always sad.
Yeah.
So can we walk through now, and please correct me, but so April 26th, 2010, mm-hmm. correct? Okay. So yeah. Can you walk me through that day?
So it was a typical Monday. I was already up getting ready for work. And while I was getting ready for work, also trying to wake Allie up so that she could get out and make the bus on time. And, you know, once I heard that she was up and moving around, you kind of left her alone to get up and get ready. And that was very typical. So when she yelled, you know, "Mom, I'm going out to the bus," I never laid eyes on her after she woke up. So she went out for the bus and she actually got on the bus on time because there were some mornings, not very often, but, you know, every now and then I would have to run her up to school because she wasn't ready on time. And then I got ready for work and then left. But throughout the day, what was different was she was texting, which she shouldn't have been texting from school.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, asking, like one time she asked if she could stay after school to make up some schoolwork. I think she had been sick a couple of weeks prior and her teacher was going to let her make something up. So my concern with that was, how late is it going to be? Do I need to come pick you up? How are you going to get home? You know, all that logistical stuff. And then I guess she checked with her teacher and then she texted me back and she said, well, the teacher can't stay after school today. So I'm like, okay, I'll see you after school. And then she texted a little while later and asked if she could walk to work to see if she could work and go ahead and pick up her paycheck. And I did not like that idea at all. I'd never let her walk to work. So I'm like, no, just wait till I get home and then I'll take you up there to get your check. Because normally when she got this job, my mom would be over here at my house and mom would take her to work and drop her off. And then after work, I would go pick her up. So that was different about this day. And she was so adamant because she wanted to work. I mean, what kid doesn't want to, you know, cook hamburgers and fries, you know, and get paid for it? She knew all the right things to say. She promised that she would be walking straight there and that she would be okay. And reluctantly, I did end up changing my mind and I told her, okay. That was the last communication, was me telling her it was okay. Mm. And yeah, that was it.
And Allie worked at Burger Barn.
Yeah, she it was her very first job. Called the Burger Barn, and it was right down here at the main intersection. To walk it, it's only a quarter of a mile, maybe a little bit less. and would have taken her 10 to 15 minutes just at a normal pace. And for a while, actually, until these past couple of months, we thought that the kids on the bus were the last people to see her. There was two boys that lived a little bit farther down the street. So they would all get off, typically, they would all get off the bus. And then Allie's house was first, and then the other boys would continue walking. So that particular day, they recalled Allie stopping where the stop sign is, where the bus drops them off. And she turned to walk out of the neighborhood after sending a text. And then they came down the street. Until recently, I was reminded that somebody said that they told me 16 years ago that, and it was a close friend of mine. As a matter of fact, she was at my house helping me get stuff ready for CrimeCon. And we were just having a casual conversation. And she's like, you know, I can't believe that there was nobody else that saw Allie that day except for the boys on the bus and my sister. And I was like, what are you talking about? And I couldn't believe what she was telling me. And now I do have a potty mouth. So there was all kinds of like WTF. And I'm like,
you can cuss on this podcast, by the way. It's welcome.
Okay.
I'm also a potty mouth.
Okay. Okay. So my dad literally was a sailor. Yeah. So I blame that on him. And plus, you know, when you've been stressed out for so long like I have, you know, it just makes you feel better when you just say a bad word.
Exactly. But, yes.
So my friend Sharon, you know, proceeded to tell me, you know, she's like, yeah, you know, I told you just a couple of days after Allie went missing that my sister says she saw Allie. And so I got all those details from her. And then why don't I remember this? I was so upset about this. I was so upset with myself because I've done multiple podcasts the past 16 years, and I've always said the last people to see Allie were the boys on the bus. So now I'm able to say that, you know, there was one more person that saw her actually outside of our neighborhood. So I texted Allie's father and I'm like, John, do you remember it? Sharon's sister saying anything about this? And he's like, no, why are they just now saying it, you know, just like me? And I'm like, well, this is the conversation. And the only thing that I could think of was that maybe back then we didn't think it was that important and we didn't write it down. And yeah, so or trauma brain or something.
Sure.
So with that being said, I'm like, well, you know, what do I do with this information now? Is it going to do anything at all? So I sent an email to Detective Hayes at Harris County. And I'm like, you know, this is the conversation that I just had with my really close friend. And if you've heard me talk about the case before, you know that my relationship with law enforcement has been strained, to put it very nicely.
Yeah. Which is understandable because Allie was labeled a runaway and there was no Amber Alert issued and you had to do everything yourself pretty much.
Yeah, in a nutshell, definitely. So what I did and what I put in the email, I did it intentionally because if anybody out there has ever worked with law enforcement, they're not under any legal obligation to give you any type of feedback. So all of these tips and everything that we send in, some of it we don't know if they did anything with it or not. Mm-hmm. So I'm putting this email together to Detective Hayes and giving him basically the conversation and friends named Sharon and her sister Susie, and that I did not give them their phone numbers or how to contact them. And it took me a day to process all of this and to send him an email. And so I emailed it after work the following day. And I was checking my email the next morning and I saw that he emailed me back at like 10:30 that night. I was like, ooh, okay. And he's like, I need their phone numbers. And I'm like, okay, he read my email. So that made me really happy just to have that little bit of acknowledgement. And I sent him the information back and I texted my friend Sharon and I'm like, you know, this is what happened. I said, you might be getting a call. And sure enough, I mean, she calls me within just a few hours and she said, he just called and he called Susie. And I'm like, yay. And a couple more hours go by and she calls me back. She's like, he just called us back again and asked us all the same questions, but he recorded it. So now in my mind, I'm thinking, okay, maybe this really is something, you know, if he not just spoke to them, but, you know, he's now recording it. So that's the latest that we have to go by for anything. I mean, from my point of view, 16 years of doing our own investigating, following every little tip and information that comes in, and it leads nowhere because the last clues that we had was Allie getting off the bus.
Right.
And the last people that saw her were in the neighborhood. And now this puts her a couple of blocks away. So maybe she did make it to the Burger Barn. Maybe something happened there. Maybe something happened in that shorter distance between where she was seen and the Burger Barn. So there's so many more questions now that we don't have answers to yet, but I hope they're being looked into.
Usually when new questions arise, it can be a good sign, though, that there's, yeah, that means there's more things to look at least. Yeah, I know. I'm crossing all my fingers, all my toes. I know you guys had to sift through so many tips, too, and that there was also some surveillance footage. Could you talk to us about that?
So because as far as like the investigation at the beginning, we did most of it ourselves because they labeled Allie a runaway. And just to give you a little bit of history, so we live in Harris County. And because law enforcement is county, there's different divisions that we had to go through. So we had to go through the local precinct when we first called to report Allie missing. And them wanting to label her a runaway and not taking a missing person report. So we called the Laura Recovery Center. And I think it had been already 48 hours by then. And when they came, they took it very seriously. She is missing. She is not where she's supposed to be. And something happened. So they started organizing and actually doing things. Like they put together a missing person flyer and got it out there on social media. They were calling the news stations to try to get her face out there. But because it wasn't coming from law enforcement, the news stations weren't really grabbing it at first. And if you think back at early 2010, the BP oil spill had also happened. So that was taking up the majority of all of the news stations and what they were talking about, you know, was the cleanup from that and who was responsible and stuff like that. So I would say it was probably almost a week that went by before we got any news coverage. And then once it did hit the news, that's when we feel that enforcement was kind of forced to come and help. So it went from the case went from our local precinct to the Harris County Runaway Division. And by then, John had already been to the high school. He had been to the Burger Barn. He had been to the bus barn at the school because there was surveillance cameras on the buses. So we were able to actually see what she was wearing that day, because that was very difficult because I didn't see her that morning. So I didn't know what she was wearing. So he got that. So he got the images. If you've ever Googled Allie, there's images of her on the school bus. So John got those. And he went to the gas station up at the intersection. They had video surveillance. They were the only store in that intersection to have surveillance. So they burned him a copy of the surveillance for that whole day. And he brought it home and we watched it because we were watching for Allie to walk across the top of the screen because the gas station was across the street. And we never saw Allie walk across the screen. So we're like, okay, well, what do we do now? So we were thinking that law enforcement could look at the vehicles that were going through the intersection. And so we handed the surveillance over to the runaway detectives. And we're like, okay, you know, this is good. They can look at the vehicles, and we gave it to them to do what they needed to do. And a couple of months after that, we found out that that footage was lost. Yeah. But Detective Hayes, when he came on to the case last year, he told me that he would try his best to find that surveillance and review it, or I don't know if he could even find it.
I don't even know. Like, I mean, there's not adequate words to describe how that must have felt, the fact that that happened. And that's not the first time I've heard that in other true crime cases, very important evidence getting lost. And I don't understand how that happens with these professionals. I know you also had to do your own cell phone pings, or you pinged Allie's cell phone. Mm-hmm. What was that like, and what did you find doing that?
Well, I first did it the night that I couldn't find her, that first night. And it was a little difficult because we didn't have a home computer. So if I ever wanted to see where she was, typically I would log in from my office computer at work and just see, oh, you know, where is she at? Is she on her way home? Stuff like that, because I could see the movement on her phone. So when I went to her boyfriend's house, DJ, he had also been trying to call her and text her. I was telling him and his mom that I'll have to wait till I go to work, and then because I don't have a computer, I can't see where her phone is. So they let me log in to their computer, and it didn't find her phone. So when I did look at the last position of it, it was at the cell phone tower right here by our subdivision. And it wasn't long after that, I had to go buy a laptop. So I bought a laptop. That way I could do some of these things myself instead of asking everybody else, friends and family, to, can you look at this on the computer? Can you look at that? If you've heard me talk before, having a missing person is not cheap. I can't stress that enough. That's why I've had to fundraise in the past. But yeah, so I printed out all of her phone records. Just for the month of April, she had sent over 4,000 text messages, which I'm not completely surprised. She was on her phone a lot, and it was a new phone for her as well. She had never had her own cell phone until Christmas of that year, because if you think about 2010, not all teenagers had phone.
That is true. I got my first phone in eighth grade, so I was 13, 14. But yeah, not everybody had one. And we had the T9 texting.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. 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 So Allie was, I mean, that was her thing. I mean, she was constantly on her phone or texting her friends. But it wasn't a smartphone, you know, like they make today. It did have Safari capabilities, but back then, anytime she would even just touch the Safari app, it would charge me like that. And I would get a ping on my phone saying that, oh, you know, you have $5 for, you know, blah, 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 you know, however much time was spent on Safari. So I really had to stress to her to stay off of it. And she understood. So she's like, Mom, I'm so sorry. She said, I didn't mean to open that app. So it was little things like that. But yeah, that phone was just an extension of her hand at the time. And so I printed out all these phone records, and there was hundreds of pages. And, you know, we have AT&T, and AT&T, they didn't back up the data. So the only thing we had were the time stamps with the phone number and the send and receive. So at like 12 o'clock, she sent a text message to whatever phone number. So we had to, some of the phone numbers, I knew who they belonged to, and some of them we didn't. So with the help of the Laura Recovery Center and my mother-in-law, we went through those hundreds of pages of the data and just compiled a list of the phone numbers and who they belong to. A lot of them we had to call and say, you know, hi, do you know Allie Lowitzer? She's missing. Who is this? You know, basically. And some of them, I think there was two or three phone numbers that were tied to Las Vegas, but we were told that it was somebody's mom's phone number and they just never changed it over or something like that. Yeah. So that was, an interesting lesson to have to learn.
Yeah. I mean, you had to play detective and do all of this work. As far as the cell phone records go, did anything significant come from that? Because I know she was texting when she was walking, that according to eyewitnesses.
Well, the last person that she was texting with was her friend Jay. So naturally, John went over to his house to ask him what the conversation was about. And we were all curious. And he said that she was asking him what he was going to do after school and if he wanted to come over and hang out if she didn't work. So, I mean, that's his word. So there's no proof.
According to him, she was making plans to come back home and, mm-hmm. you know, hang out. I think that's significant, at least.
Yeah.
Okay. So what are the updates, if any? What does the case look like now? I know we talked about the recent sighting tip. Any other mm-hmm. things that are of significance that you guys are working on?
No.
Okay.
No, we continuously have things come in, you know, not like every single day, but typically what would come in is through the Hope Rally Facebook page. I would have somebody message me and send me a picture of a young lady that they found somewhere on social media. And they would ask me, you know, this looks a lot like Allie, you know, could it be Allie? And if you think about it, it's been 16 years. Mm-hmm. Allie's not going to look 16 years old anymore. And most of the pictures sent recently, you know, have been of a teenager. And what I do with that is I'll ask them for a link to where they found the image. And so that I can go look firsthand at the image instead of just a screenshot. I'll try to rule it out myself. I can't tell you how many I've done that for throughout the 16 years. Because if I were to send every single one of them over to law enforcement and not hear anything back, it would drive me insane. So I tried to do most of the tip solving myself. And if it's something of significance, then I'll either send it over to my advocate, which she does some investigating for me, or I'll send it over to law enforcement.
So you're still to this day doing, like, it sounds like daily things where you get messages and you're going and you're having to follow up, and mm-hmm. that sounds exhausting.
It is exhausting, but also when it's quiet, it's really hard.
Mm.
Meaning, if there's not anything going on with the investigation and too much time has gone by, you know, then that's when I try to think of something else where I can get her face out there again to generate more information. Like going to CrimeCon, you know, I met so many wonderful people at CrimeCon, and now those hundreds of people now know about Allie. And I mean, who knows if they're going to be out and about somewhere and they may see somebody that they could be Allie. You know, I would hope that they would reach out to me somehow or call in a tip or something. But when it's quiet, yeah, that's when I do a lot of thinking, and I'll do, you know, a lot of social media work and TikTok and YouTube and stuff like that and fundraising and all that good stuff.
That makes a lot of sense. You want to keep the traffic going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I don't like it when it's quiet. I mean, yeah. I do take advantage of some downtime for sure, because I get depressed and I do like to sit still and just gather everything and feel a little normal.
Of course.
But then once it's continuous, that's when I'm like, okay, what do I need to do? So I need to be busy again.
Gotta find those ways to keep going and yeah, be able
Yeah.
to yeah, I mean I totally get that need for normalcy that I would imagine balancing can be
Yeah.
tough.
Yeah. Yeah. So I do a lot of crafting. I didn't for the longest time, but when I'm making stuff with my hands, it just, I know it sounds weird, but I feel a little bit closer to Allie because we did so much crafting together. I still enjoy creating things, but now it's more meaningful, you know, whether I'm making and creating something for my next event or something for CrimeCon or a fundraiser, something like that. I always try to put some type of meaning behind
I don't think that's weird at all. I think that totally makes
it.
sense. When you started talking
Okay.
about crafting, I immediately was like, oh, that makes sense because Allie was very artsy and I
Yeah.
clearly got that from you.
Oh.
So my note that I said I forgot that I would come back to, for people that are listening that aren't familiar with Allie's case, something significant is that her phone was pretty quickly shut off at the time of her disappearance. So I just wanted to make sure people knew that and wanted to ask you what your thoughts are on that. What would have caused that in your opinion, or if the police had any
Right.
thoughts about that?
Well, if the police did have any thoughts about it, they haven't told me. That's kind of the theme with law enforcement and my case. But I've had to learn a lot. And what I've learned that if you shut off a cell phone, you know, with the power button back then, it might be different now, I'm not sure. But back then, it was silent. Your phone went silent. If you took out the battery or if you took your phone and you smashed it, that would all cause the phone to be invisible, basically. So the last activity on her phone was just a few moments after she got off the bus and she texted Jay, and then that was it. After that, it was absolutely quiet. And I actually kept that cell phone number up until, gosh, probably maybe 3 years ago. And since we're on a cell phone subject, me and one of my private investigators, probably about 10 years ago, I went to AT&T and I actually bought a new cell phone and had them put that phone number on it. And from that, we were able to do a recovery for Allie's email because she had a Yahoo email. And you know how you can do the password recovery type of deal to get into the account.
Yeah.
So, you know, it took a little finagling, but we did end up getting into that account. And there was only one email. It was in her sent box. Everything else was completely gone, which was very odd.
Yeah.
And I think we were also able to recover her MySpace account, which, you know, back then MySpace was you know, a big deal. Or
Oh, yeah.
I think Facebook was new back then. And we did find, not through the cell phone, but we did find that she had, I think, two Facebook accounts because, you know, it was intermittent when she was able to get a computer to be able to log on to it. So she had forgotten her password a couple of times for Facebook. That's why she had more than one account. But yeah, the MySpace account, it just had pictures and just a couple of friends on there. Not a big deal. But yeah, the email being wiped out was really strange.
I would agree for sure. When were you guys able to get into her email?
I think it was about 10 years ago.
Okay.
So probably, oh, maybe a little bit longer. She's been missing for 16 years. So maybe it was like 3 or 4 years after she went missing.
The other thing I just thought about too that I want to make sure listeners are aware of is there was no trace of Allie found at all. There's never been any clothing, anything that could seemingly be connected to her. And my understanding is you guys volunteers did a pretty extensive search.
Yeah, the Laura Recovery Center, they organized searches for months. You know, at the beginning, it was every single day of the week for weeks. And then when a lot of the surrounding area started to be complete, you know, with the searching, they started just searching on weekends. And eventually I had to go back to work. And that was really hard. And I think John went back to work before I did. And gosh, it was so hard to go back to work. I couldn't concentrate. Yeah. I didn't want to. Yeah, I don't know why that makes me emotional, because I mean, my coworkers were so wonderful. They were very supportive. And I even had several coworkers come out to the searches. They would take a day of vacation and with their boss's permission, and come out and participate in the searches. And that meant a lot to me. There's not many of those coworkers left in my office. they've moved on to different jobs now. But yeah, it was hard when the searches stopped completely. It was really hard. And the feelings from that was like, you know, okay, what do we do now? But when you feel like you've exhausted every area to search, you know, every culvert, every ditch, every creek, every single patch of woods that, I mean, for miles and miles, it's like, what's next? I mean, yeah, it's heartbreaking, because I never look at a ditch the same way anymore. Because at the beginning, they wouldn't let me go out there and participate in the searches. Families aren't allowed to participate. So, you know, I was concentrating on the tips that were coming in and fundraising and making sure that all of the searchers had water and snacks and food. And then finally, I guess it was probably more than 6 months after Allie went missing, if the Laura Recovery Center, if they weren't able to organize a search for us, then me and John were doing it ourselves. And we would call our friends and our new friends, the ones that were coming and helping searching. And yeah, we would go do it ourselves. And when you're out there, like, here's an example. One time we were searching like a pipeline where it's, and I know not everybody knows what that is. So it's a really large clearing that's really long. And sometimes there's some fencing and sometimes there's a lot of drainage and stuff like that. So we parked on the street. There was probably five or six cars, and we got out and we were all searching. We all had our gear on, and we came across this area that had these long, greasy black streaks in the grass that it looked like something was drug through the grass, and it ended up being blood. So if you think about a cut or a scrape at the blood, it doesn't stay red. So it when it dries, it gets dark. And then we found black plastic bags. And then we saw long chunks of black curly hair. And it all led, these streaks led down to a small, not really like a creek, but I guess more like a bayou type of drainage. And I didn't freak out, but maybe I did internally. But it was very, very concerning to me. And I'm like, we need somebody to come and check this out, see what the fuck this is, you know? Because, at the time that Allie went missing, she had dark hair,
right?
But it was dyed like a magenta color, but it was long. She had long hair. And so, I mean, it very well could have been Allie's hair. Here's a picture of her and her dark hair. And so we called the local precinct, and he showed up pretty quick because we told them who we were and that Allie had been missing and this is what we're doing, you know, and all this other stuff. So we led him over to this area, and he's like, oh, well, this is from a hog. I'm like, what about this blood, the blood streaks and the plastic bags? And he said that it looks like somebody went hog hunting, and instead of cleaning the hog, or I guess processing the hog for its meat or whatever, instead of doing it at their house, they did it by this area. Yeah. So I'm like, okay.
There's a big difference between looks like and this is in fact what this is.
Yeah.
Do your job.
Yeah.
Also, there's a big difference between hog hair and what looks like human hair.
Yeah.
I've seen hogs.
Well, so he did, because we didn't touch anything. So he brought gloves with him and he picked it up. He picked up some of the big clumps of hair. And he's like, if you look really close at this hair, it's really coarse. There's no way that it's human hair. But he really did seem to know what he was talking about. But yeah, I will never in my life forget that because
right.
I'm like, you know, could this be what we were looking for?
Right. Something that
yeah.
my friend Jules has said before, which you got to meet her at CrimeCon also. She's searched for missing persons, and she
uh-huh.
always says she goes into it knowing we might find this loved one or we might find someone else's loved one. And
uh-huh.
so it's just that constant thought of like, you never know who or what you're going to find. So,
yeah. And
yeah.
And when I joined Texas EquiSearch, and, you know, so I have formal training now. And every time I went on a call out to search for somebody, I always like, okay, I'm not searching for Allie, but she could still be out there. That was my mindset. You know, I'm like, I know I'm searching for this older man that has Alzheimer's that went missing. But there could always be the chance that I could find something else out there.
I love that you got into that as well.
Yeah, it's going to be part of my life forever now.
Mm-hmm.
And why not, with that being a part of my life, why not try to do all that I can in that aspect? You know, I've been to, what is that, A&M in San Marcos, and took I took a couple of classes with my fellow Texas EquiSearch people. You know, we took the human versus animal bone class, where we got to learn, is this little tiny piece, is it from a deer or is it from a human finger? And then we took the body recovery class, where we actually, alongside actual college students, we got to process and recover buried bodies. So that was, yeah.
Wow.
I'll
yeah, that's
never,
intense.
Never forget that. Very intense. So we got to walk through, they call it the body farm. So we got to walk through the body farm and see the different stages of decomposition. And the students that are actually taking these courses, they are assigned their own donated body when people donate their body to science. And so we got to see their, I hate to call it an experiment, but we got to see how they positioned and put their person out in the body farm. So, for example, like one was completely caged, where no animals or anything could get to it, just to see how the elements take care of the body. And then we had another one several feet away, where it was completely out in the open and any animal can have at it, basically. But they would have cameras that would record the process. And to me, that was very interesting, because I try to, along this journey, I've tried to compare my case with other cases. And my really good friend today, they were having a search for her daughter that's been missing for 6 years. And if you think about what may have happened to her daughter, not just the elements, but nature as well. I mean, that the person is not going to be in the same place that they were put, basically. I mean, unless it's buried deep, 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 which most normal homicides, nothing's normal about a homicide, but a lot of people are just discarded. And so I don't know why I went down that rabbit hole. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
But I don't get to talk about that aspect of it very often, because most people just want to hear about the case directly, and instead of what some of us families go through and what we learn.
Well, I think that's extremely important. And Yeah, I mean, I'm always curious about like what the family dynamic was like, what it looks like after the fact. Those stories of, yeah, you having to go back to work and somehow act like life is normal again. And I love that you've been able to learn and get out and help other people in the midst of all of this.
Yeah, it was hard. I didn't think that I would ever be doing something like this in my entire life. And I believe that everything happens for a reason, whether it just be God or the higher power. And maybe Allie went missing so that I could help somebody else. You
Wow.
know, I know that I've met a lot of wonderful families because of Allie. And I have found my voice
Yes.
because of Allie. But yeah, so yeah.
Your tears are welcome here. It's okay. Of
Thank you.
course.
It's hard to let them go sometimes because I feel like that I don't know how I feel sometimes, but if that makes any
Oh,
sense. But
girl,
you
I
know, some
understand that.
I mean, and sometimes it's happy
Yeah.
tears. It's not, you know, all sad, but when I think about all the other families out there that are going through, you know, the same thing as me, you know, I'm like, there's just got to be something that can be done to help them. And if I can do something to help them, then I'm going to do it.
Well, you are, and you understand what they're going through. And I would imagine going through something like that can feel very, I mean, it feels like so many things, but also very lonely. So I'm
It
sure for
does.
them it can be very helpful.
Yeah.
This might be like a big question, and it's okay if you're like, I don't know, but what message do you want to leave people with? And that could be just the people listening to this. It could be, you know, what you've learned. I don't know. But is there a message or something that you want to say to people listening today?
Well, not to sound like a broken record, but it's for me and families like mine, it's just important that you don't turn a blind eye when you see something, say something. In Allie's case, you know, for me, that is so important because I know somebody knows something, but they're not saying anything. And I have people on social media, they'll ask me all the time, but, you know, they'll say, what can we do to help? And I'm like, well, give me the winning lotto numbers, you know. But no, I'm like, just share the missing person flyers. And just that, to see how many people has shared a video or a picture of a missing person, you know, those numbers matter. They matter to me and the other families, you know, that have a missing person. And when I put something out on TikTok, even though, you know, it's just a little video of Allie with some music, just share it, because our hope one day is that the right person is going to see that and eventually say something.
With where we're at in the world right now, I feel like social media can be a weapon, but it can also be such a powerful tool. And so I totally agree. I think it takes 2 seconds. I say this all the time, but it takes 2 seconds. So just clicking, interacting, it really does help so much. And it feeds the annoying algorithm, but that's how it works. And yeah, I totally agree.
Social media has been a huge tool when it comes for missing persons.
Yes, no, absolutely. And it's
Yeah.
also like, I mean, when I started the show a couple of years ago, it could feel very daunting at the same time where it's like, I don't know what I'm doing. How do you? So I would imagine learning all of that was also a challenge. And I mean,
Yes.
I'm learning stuff every week still with like,
Yeah.
wait, how do you use this tool? So
Yeah. I think I was on TikTok for probably almost an entire year before I posted anything about Allie. And I think I told you about that at CrimeCon, about my TikTok account being banned,
You
right?
did, yes.
Yeah. So I had built up like 40,000 something followers. And then when TikTok sold, I got banned. And I'm like, what the fuck?
That's insane. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So I'm like, what did I do wrong? And I didn't do anything wrong.
You have a new account? Are you out of TikTok jail?
I had to create a new account.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Now it's under Hope for Allie. Instead of my name, it's under Hope for Allie.
Because sometimes when you get banned, like, you can't even make a new account. They'll like,
yeah,
it'll like link to your email or whatever. It's insane.
Yeah. I had to use a completely different email. I did not link it to my phone number because I tried that. Yeah. So and it's like, fine, I'll just go to YouTube.
Well, I have one more question for you. Uh-huh. What do you think happened that day?
I think somebody took her. Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's a big question in itself. Who took her? Why did they take her? Was it somebody that she knew? Was it a complete stranger? Those are the questions in my mind that go along with your question.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I could go down a rabbit hole of different scenarios that could have happened. Was it somebody that she knew? Was it intentional? Or was it some of her friends and then something happened? It's not completely unheard of that there's been accidents with kids and they try to cover it up. Example is Skylar Niece. I don't know if you're familiar with her story, but two of her best friends murdered her and covered it up. And I'm friends with her mom. But, you know, so I'm like, what friends would it be and what may have happened? You know, so I go down that rabbit hole. And then was it a sex offender? Is she being held in not a basement because we don't have basements here in Texas, but is she being held somewhere against her will? Maybe she's alive. And was she sex trafficked? And yeah, so the only thing that we know is just somebody took her, but we don't know why.
I know that you are trying to fundraise for CrimeCon next year.
I am, yeah.
And that you're making a t-shirt.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
So I'm going to make sure that all of your links, anything that you want in the episode description is there, but including that fundraiser link, and it's going to be going all over the socials. So everybody, absolutely. So everybody listening, if you are able to give anything at all, please donate. That link will be in the episode description. And yeah, just I so appreciate you coming on and taking all of this time to tell your story, to tell Allie's story, and just educating my listeners on the case. I'll be totally transparent with you. I don't live far from you, and I hadn't heard of Allie's case until we connected.
Oh, wow.
That just goes to show there's so many more people that don't know the story that need to know it. So I really, really appreciate it.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for kind of letting me have free range of what to talk about, because usually it's just a answer a question or question and answer type of conversation. And you let me talk about things that I have never talked about.
Oh, that makes me happy.
So I appreciate that.
That's important.
You know, it is. Anytime and it took me a long time to get to this point where I could have a conversation without sounding completely crazy. But I don't remember what my point was, speaking of crazy. But
that's okay. It's your story. Yeah. That's how it should be told when possible, is in your words. That's your story. I feel like that's the most accurate way to present it to people. So absolutely. Yeah.
But it was nice. It was nice to talk about things that I don't talk about every single time.
So
thank you for that.
You're very welcome. Well, anything else before we wrap up the recording?
No, I don't think so. You know, just if you see something, say something.
Yeah, very, very good words to live by. I have wristbands and bracelets from CrimeCon, all of the missing persons bracelets that I was gifted. They're sitting on my table back there. And my goal is that I go through all of them one by one this year and make connections, make contact, do similar things to what we did today.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Well, thank you everybody for listening to today's episode with Allie Lewitzer's mom. Thank you. And do you go by Joe or Joanne? I just want to make sure.
I go by both. Both. I go by okay. Allie's mom, Mace's mom, hey you, you know.
Okay. Because I was calling you Joanne for like the past couple weeks, and then I saw the name on the Zoom recording, Joe, and I was like, wait, let me make sure. So, but yes, thank you everyone for listening to today's interview episode. And if you enjoyed it, interact in any way you can. It helps get this information out to more people, and that's always much appreciated. And yes, just Joe, thanks again. This was wonderful.
Very welcome. Thank you.
You all are amazing. I hope you have a great week. Please stay safe, and I will talk to you next week. Bye. Bye. Perplexity, a Mystery Podcast is hosted, written, and produced by me, Kadra Brannon. The show is proud to be a part of the Black Cat Network. Editing is by myself and Charlie Leopold. Theme song by Patrick Thompson. If you want ad-free episodes and exclusive bonus content, you can always join the Perplexed Society at patreon.com/perplexitymysterypodcast. If you have a topic request or a listener story, you can always submit those to perplexitymysterypodcast@gmail.com. Business inquiries can be sent via email. Additional support links along with merch can be found in the episode description. Until next week, stay curious.